quasi-cerebral talk and tunes. This is Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. Here's what we've got cooking up this hour. You are tuned in to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. We are the campus community radio station broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast on the unceded Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Kwikwetlem First Nations. This episode of Typically Tuesdays was produced on the unceded Coast Salish territories of the Katsi, Kwikwetlem, and Stoa First Nations. And at Typically Tuesdays, we recognize the host nations as being the original storytellers and knowledge keepers of these lands, and we thank them for their stewardship. My name is Leslie. September is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. It's an occasion that comes around once a year, and I find that the topic of suicide is one that most people are not really apt at discussing, even during this month. It's understandable, but I think it's quite a shame, and also it actually does more harm than good. Suicide, admittedly, is hard to talk about. It's difficult to acknowledge for some people, and for a lot of people, it's hard to understand. But framing it in these ways, I think, makes prevention and awareness about suicide prevention that much harder to attain. I think, and ultimately, to prevent suicide is to lean into care and promote healing in a community-based form, and that can't be done well if we're going to dance around the topic uncomfortably. So on today's episode of Typically Tuesdays, I'm going to talk about suicide prevention and why love and community care are absolutely integral to all preventative measures. I'm going to start off by talking about suicidality and pain. Then I'll be talking about the flaws of the systems that are put in place that claim to offer support. And then finally, towards the end of the episode, I'm going to be sharing some suggestions as to how I think you can best support loved ones who are really going through it. So this is a pretty heavy topic and it's going to be a pretty heavy episode. I'm going to lay down some ground rules. The first one is I'm going to be talking about mental illness, suicidality, suicide, colonialism, anti-Black racism, anti-Asian racism, police brutality, ableism, forced institutionalization, and sanism throughout this episode. I'm also going to be talking about medical assistance in dying and the opioid crisis. So please take care of yourself if you're going to keep listening. And if you don't think that you can, come back next week or check out the archived episode of the program later on this week on cjsf.ca, during which you can skip through discussions that you don't want to hear about. The second thing to note here for today's episode is that it's not going to be about political suicides. I think death is political, and suicide in many cases, as I'll be discussing today, is also a political topic and can be political as well. But I'm not going to be focusing on politics as being the main motivator of suicide, because very often things like that, such as like self-immolation, they don't have a strong correlation with mental health crises and mental illness. Rather, a lot of the times when those things happen, the strongest correlation there is political resistance. I want to make that very, very clear. If you're interested to hear more about that topic, political suicides, necropolitics, you can check out the March 4th, 2024 episode of Typically Tuesdays, which is on the CJSF archives right now on cjsf.ca. In this episode, I'm going to be focusing on suicidality and suicide prevention in the context of mental health. And three, if you choose to sit through today's episode, you need to know you're going to be made quite uncomfortable, because I'm going to have a really frank discussion about suicide, and that's an unnerving topic. But I'm doing this because I want to encourage you to really lean into the discomfort. In order to destigmatize suicidality and suicide, we need to talk about it truthfully. And if you choose to listen to today's episode, I hope that you take that as an opportunity to interrogate your own discomfort. I didn't really know how else to frame this, and why I think it's so important. So I'm going to paraphrase my therapist, who actually gave me some really great pointers in preparation for today's episode, and she suggested that if we're going to do suicide prevention awareness, we need to speak to it directly in order to do so. This can help us destigmatize it, and also it helps us create space and awareness for us to reflect on our own experiences of mental health, care, and stigma. So I'm tackling today's episode as somebody who's had held several positions about suicide throughout my life. I know what it's like to be the person who was unnerved by disclosure of suicidality and act judgmentally and coldly because I didn't know how to approach supporting the person who disclosed, and ultimately that ended up causing harm. I know what it's like to experience suicidality and have no viable, safe resources to turn to. I also know what it's like to develop a stronger, better understanding of pain and care and support in order to help the people I care about move through a crisis. And I'm sharing that because I want you to know that I'm not just talking out of my butt here. I have a vested interest in promoting preventative strategies that center care and healing, but I am no expert in the sense that I'm not like a scientific person or anything like that. A lot of the science and social discussion around this topic I've gathered from a number of sources in preparation for today's episode, and of course some of what I'm going to be talking about today come from my own opinions and my own lived experience as well. So on today's playlist we've got a short one. It's folky tracks, you know, some old, some new, some sad, some hopeful. Get into it. Here's the first track by Lebanese folk musician Issam Hajali. This is Intazarn. خلف الظهر مقيدة ولكني أغني أنا لم أخنك فلا تخني أنا لم أبعك فلا تبعني أنا لم أخنك فلا تخني أنا لم أبعك فلا تبعني عنقي على السكين يا وطني ولكني أقول لك انتظرني ويداي خلف الظهر مقيدة ولكني أغني أنا لم أخنك فلا تخني أنا لم أبعك فلا تبعني أنا لم أخنك فلا تخني أنا لم أبعك فلا تبعني The newest from Tasha off of the record All This and So Much More, that was Be Better. Here on Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM, my name is Leslie. I'm talking about suicide prevention on Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. How do we go about understanding suicidality? Well, according to Dr. DeQuincy Mifrin-Lazine, who appeared on the Ologies podcast a few weeks ago on an episode about suicidology, and it was really, really good, and that's where I got like a lot of my like kind of like scientific understandings of suicidality from. Go check it out. But according to him, there is no one profile for a suicidal person. They could be somebody who is experiencing a lot of isolation, or a person who's lacking basic material resources, such as safe and long-term housing and adequate healthcare. They could be a person who's experiencing unaddressed and inadequately addressed mental health issues. They could be a person experiencing discrimination, bullying, harassment, abuse, or oppression. These examples are just a few and simply offer an idea of the broad range of reasons as to why a person may become suicidal. But I think based off of my own lived experiences and also having discussed this topic with my therapist as well in preparation for today's episode, I think that suicidality is a coping mechanism for pain. There are a few myths about suicidality that are common in the mainstream. You've probably heard of them before. Just some of them are that a person who is suicidal is actually seeking attention, or that they're just weak and selfish for wanting to take the easy way out. But perhaps we can consider it in this way, right? If a person is who claims to be suicidal is doing so simply for attention, then what is it exactly they want to raise attention about? If a person who claims to be suicidal is weak, then what burden have they been shouldering that has caused them to weaken? If a person who claims to be suicidal is apparently selfish for wanting to take the easy way out of life, what makes you feel as though they ought to give more? What is it they ought to keep giving? And do they have the means to do so? I want to really encourage you to think logically about this. If a person has said seriously that they no longer want to live, what does that actually mean? Should that not raise a red flag? To what extent does that signal that perhaps something is wrong and perhaps you should be concerned about the well-being of that person? And here's another way to frame it. To what extent are you open to knowing about why a person is suicidal? What has brought them to that stage in their life? As I mentioned earlier this episode, I've held several positions throughout my life about the topic of suicide. And when I was a teenager, I was really ignorant and felt that suicidal people simply wanted the attention. That's something that I really, really regret now. And I don't think people should hold this position ever. I remember when I was younger, I had a friend who disclosed to me their suicidal thoughts, and I acted really coldly. At the same time, I had grown close with this person, and I knew about the struggles that they were experiencing, a new mental health diagnosis that had isolated them from their family and friends. They were experiencing identity issues. They had ongoing family problems beyond just the identity issues and the mental health diagnosis. They were a teenager. That's pretty hard. And plus, they didn't have the most understanding circle of friends, which included me. Combined, of course, these factors would be heavy burdens on a person who felt that they had an inadequate support system. And it would make sense that they would have a hard time feeling as though they would want to move forward in life. Consider this then. If life is so intolerably painful that one loses the motivation to go on living, of course, it would make sense that perhaps they would develop suicidal thoughts. Death or fantasies about death can then serve as a tool of comfort to put an end to the pain. And so then, what is pain? This I also got from an episode of Ologies about pain with Dr. Rachel Zofness. So check out that episode as well. But according to neuroscientist Dr. Rachel Zofness, pain is your body's warning system. It exists to protect you and save your life. It sits at the intersection of three sources: the physical, or the bio, the psychological, and the social. In Zofness' words, pain is, quote, biopsychosocial. The first is most easily understandable, relating to the body and physical experiences of pain. Nerve damage, broken bones, scrapes, and cuts. The psychological source of pain pertains to trauma, memory, emotions, and coping mechanisms. One example that I thought I could share maybe was like, for example, I remember my stomach tattoo healing process being like the most painful of all of my tattoos. And so now whenever I get a tattoo on another part of my body, I often compare that experience of pain with the memory of my stomach pieces healing. It was not fun. Finally, pain is social as well. Dr. Zofna says that it's, quote, everything else. This pertains to access to care, support networks, experiences of oppression, socioeconomic status, isolation, or community. All pain is biopsychosocial. Consider what would happen then if one of those things were exacerbated. For example, if you experience a chronic pain flare-up while you are going through a breakup and your doctor keeps sending you to do tests that come out with no results as to why you have chronic pain and your doctor doesn't really seem to believe that you're experiencing a lot of pain. You know, that's a lot. That's heavy. And in addition to all of those immediate sources of pain, there could also be a whole host of other things impacting stress levels and access to support that exacerbate even your physical experience of pain. I find that a lot of people really struggle to understand suicidality as a form of pain because they cannot seem to see all three sources of it, and because we have generally a really poor understanding of what pain is. On the one hand, many of us can tolerate the signifiers of physical pain, right? A cast on a broken arm, the rubbing of a sore neck after strange sleep, rushing to the restroom because someone ate something that doesn't sit well in their stomachs, a gnarly bulbous infection. At the same time, the psychological and social aspects of pain aren't always visually signified and can often feel more abstract or subjective. I mean, hell, even physical pain sometimes is not that believable. You know, depending on who you are, a lot of the times if you belong to a group that has been historically oppressed, a doctor might not believe the pain that you're actually going through. For example, if somebody experiences excruciating pain during their menstruation cycle, their doctor might not believe that their pain is that difficult because their doctor may not menstruate. I think that the discomfort that a lot of people experience with disclosures of suicidality can depend on their willingness to accept that we can't see all sources of pain with our naked eyes. And that discomfort also puts people in vulnerable positions where they have to accept that they're going to need to support somebody shouldering pain so deep that it threatens their own lives. In some ways as well, I think the discomfort is there to protect us. We don't want to experience, you know, a vicarious pain from the person who has disclosed. Stepping into that position of discomfort, I think, can be a very daunting task, but it's through this that I think we can better understand suicide prevention, because we're looking at it right in the face, and it allows us to understand and hold space for our loved ones a little bit better. I'm going to be talking a little bit more about that after this music break. Here is Ombigazi, newest from them, Laminate the Sky. I don't remember if I played it on the show yet, but it's a good one. Enjoy!
Malagon grew up believing that birds hold spiritual significance, thanks to teachings from her Mexican heritage that her mother would share. For example,
if we were to hear an owl at night, that meant that someone was going to be passing away. Or if we saw a hummingbird, that was someone who had passed, a family member or ancestor, visiting us and kind of saying hello.
Now working for the Hispanic Access Foundation, Rosa helps connect Latino-led nonprofits with funding from the U.S. Forest Service. She also leads monthly hikes in Central Florida, sharing her love for birds and the outdoors with her community.
Most of the people that have joined one of my hikes, their first hike was with me. So I think that's another just amazing feeling to give to someone, to like open up this whole other world that is literally in our backyard and that they had never explored.
And Rosa gets to share her learning journey with the group, like when she saw her first roseate spoonbill in the Orlando wetlands.
It's a pink bird, and it's a beautiful bird. So I was really happy that we were able to like just have that moment, and the group was able to have that moment.
This week is Latino Conservation Week. Learn more on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Welcome back to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Leslie. I'm talking about suicide prevention for Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. And last we left off, we were talking about discomfort and pain, and suicidality as a coping mechanism for pain. So one of the reasons why I really wanted to talk in depth about this particular topic was, I have a lot of concerns about mainstream discussions of suicide prevention. I find that a lot of people really lean on the police, social workers, the medical system, and even the mental health system as first response tools in cases of suicidality. You know, I think most lay people do this because they might have never received a disclosure of suicidality before, and because of the discomfort that I was mentioning before, they might believe that they are ill-equipped to support their friend or their loved one who's moving through something pretty severe, so they turn immediately to like these systems and authorities. Sometimes their first response might be to call the police to perform a wellness check, or they might take their friend to the emergency room. But if you've been a regular listener of Typically Tuesdays, I'm sure you probably already know that I don't feel that either of those are viable nor safe options for people who are experiencing suicidality. And we can start off first by addressing the cops and these so-called wellness checks, right? This happens when police are called to check in on people who might be experiencing some kind of mental health crisis. The rate of police killings have risen in Canada even after the calls for defunding and disarming the police in the summer of 2020. We know a lot of the people who are killed by the police are racialized people, particularly Black folks and Indigenous folks. They represent a disproportionate number of people who experience police brutality